Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Tuesday, April 14th, and we're tackling a weighty one today, the Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex. And Maya, weighty is right. We've got a lot to unpack, and honestly, it feels like these forces aren't just intersecting anymore. They're actively reshaping the foundations of everything. Think of a beehive, a perfectly ordered system, but one deeply sensitive to external shocks. And right now, that hive is experiencing a lot of turbulence.
Always with the analogies, Alex. Okay, let's get real. Did you know that global trade passing through just three key choke points, the Strait of Hormuz, the Suez Canal, and the Panama Canal, accounts for over 50% of all maritime commerce? We're digging into how geopolitical tensions are directly impacting market volatility.
And speaking of impact, we'll be looking at risk management strategies to navigate that, which is increasingly crucial. Then it's on to the AI infrastructure race, focusing on the models, agents, and inevitably the regulation coming down the line.
Which is fascinating, considering Bitcoin's price just hit a new all-time high despite, well, everything. We'll explore how crypto fits into this shifting world order.
And finally, a question for you, Maya. Can leadership actually be taught in an environment this complex? We're diving deep into resilience.
Now that's a good question. Stay with us, we're about to find out. At 2 p.m. GMT on April 14th, 2026, Donald Trump declared a naval blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. Let's talk about economic warfare as the new normal, specifically the choke points that are suddenly everyone's obsession.
That's right. What began as a series of targeted financial sanctions has rapidly evolved into a direct contest over critical infrastructure. The escalation, as we're seeing, isn't about regime change anymore. It's about control or attempted control of the global oil supply and, more broadly, the economic order itself. Edward Fishman and Peter Thalerson's work really highlights this fundamental shift.
Economic warfare. Feels theatrical, doesn't it? Like countries are throwing spreadsheets at each other instead of missiles. But the reality is pretty serious. Fishman notes Iran pioneered a novel approach to choke point warfare, not widespread mining but targeted strikes, effectively getting the shipping industry to self-sanction.
The pattern is clear. The classic assumption was a full-scale disruption of shipping lanes. Iran's strategy has proven much more efficient and cost-effective. They've altered the risk calculus for every ship transiting the strait, forcing companies to factor in a significantly higher insurance cost and rerouting activity, even without actively blocking the waterway. This also shows, as Fishman points out, that U.S. sanctions weren't entirely effective.
Because easing those sanctions paradoxically helped Russia. The source material calls it a third way for targeted countries. It wasn't about winning, it was about creating alternatives. And that's a problem for the U.S.
It's a profound strategic miscalculation. The initial intent was to pressure Iran and Russia, but the flexibility afforded by alternative trade routes and energy partners has undercut that pressure. Russia, facing limited demand, increased prices after South Korea, the Philippines, and India increased purchases, netting an extra $200 million a day. This fundamentally alters the dynamic. Sanctions aren't a binary choice anymore.
So the U.S. thought it had a monopoly on economic coercion, but everyone's building their own escape hatches. Trump's Liberation Day tariffs were a wake-up call.
Those tariffs exposed the vulnerability of U.S. allies, prompting Europe to diversify away from U.S. economic levers. It's a choke point arms race, as Fishman describes it, countries actively identifying and weaponizing their own economic dependencies. China's rare earth export controls in 2025 were a clear signal.
A signal Washington finally understood. The partial rollback of semiconductor restrictions wasn't about being nice, it was a direct response to China flexing its control of critical materials.
It was a demonstration of leverage. China understands its position and isn't afraid to use it. The broader consequence is a scramble for economic security, where nations are bolstering their own resilience while simultaneously seeking to reduce vulnerabilities.
Which sounds unsustainable. Everyone building walls.
It is inherently. Fishman argues this fragmentation is a real risk. Unless there's coordinated action, we're heading towards a quasi-autarchy, lacking global economic coordination. He believes a Bretton Woods-style arrangement is necessary, rules for economic tools, but that's impossible with current U.S. policy.
Because the U.S. can't simultaneously threaten economic warfare and expect alliances to hold. You can't be a reliable partner while also holding a gun to everyone's head.
Investing in defensive measures like duplicate cloud services, sovereign clouds as the Europeans are pursuing, diverts resources from economic competitiveness. The U.S. is incentivizing allies to defend themselves against potential coercion.
It's like saying, trust us, but also prepare for us to screw you over.
A remarkably unproductive message. And it ties into the energy independence question. The U.S. easing sanctions demonstrates a lack of true energy independence. Despite claims to the contrary, the U.S. economy remains vulnerable to oil price shocks.
which is ironic, given the reports of a risky conflict against Iran driven by a misperception of that independence.
It's the dark side of energy independence, a confidence that obscures underlying vulnerabilities. Iran, meanwhile, benefits from blocking the Strait of Hormuz, harming the US while benefiting Europe and Asia.
Because LNG shipments can continue. It's a selective pain point. And their strategy mimics American financial sanctions, targeting a few key ships rather than every entity.
It's about changing the risk calculus for the entire shipping industry. And it's effective. As Fishman explains, while economic choke points like the dollar system work in peacetime, their potency diminishes during conflict. Sanctions relief is now achievable through counterpressure.
So Iran's built a bargaining chip and it's proving surprisingly resilient. But what about the longer terms?
The conflict may accelerate a shift in energy choke point control from the Gulf to China. Countries seeking alternatives to fossil fuels will increasingly rely on Chinese technology for renewable energy solutions, positioning China as a key gatekeeper in the next 5 to 10 years.
Suddenly, the conversation isn't just about oil. It's about solar panels, battery technology, and the entire green energy supply chain.
The implication runs deeper. That's a different kind of choke point, one with potentially longer-lasting consequences. This also impacts the geopolitical calculus around Qatar. Damage to the Ras Laffan LNG facility, estimated to take 3 to 5 years to repair, is tightening the global gas market, creating a dependency that China can exploit.
The Trump administration officially began the blockade on April 14, 2026, targeting ships connected to Iran and its oil trade. But it's not a total blockage, right?
No, it's targeted, creating a dual blockade scenario with Iran also attempting control. That dynamic increases the risk of retaliation against non-sanctioned vessels, LNG tankers from Qatar, Saudi oil shipments. And gasoline prices in the United States are the key political barometer. Trump ties his capital to energy costs.
The herd mentality deterrent effect. Intercepting a few ships discourages others, leveraging the waterway's narrowness and U.S. naval presence. A psychological barrier, not comprehensive enforcement.
The data tells a story. Traffic has drastically slowed, as Vera Bergengruen noted. The focus has shifted from regime change to a competition for economic control. The U.S. is prepared to accept substantial global economic costs to achieve this aim.
And the market is already pricing in an optimistic scenario, a return to pre-crisis conditions by the end of August. Is that realistic?
Daniel Cassidy and Jason Draho believe so, mirroring patterns observed in past geopolitical events. But that relies on a misperception of alternative supply routes. Mikkel Rosenwald and Andreas Stano show roughly 50% of pre-war oil flows are already being bypassed.
So the panic is overblown?
To some extent, yes.
The blockade isn't a direct escalation, but a strategic maneuver to force Iran's hand before alternative routes erode its value. It's abusing the card, as Rosenwald frames it, knowing it has an expiry date.
And yet the U.S. believes it can manage this without Gulf partners.
Norman Rule's assessment, but increased oil production from Saudi Arabia and the Emirates would be beneficial. And a harsh military response is anticipated if the Houthis become involved, as well as intense diplomatic engagement if China attempts transit.
And then you have Zayed Dayad pointing out the U.S. security commitment to the Gulf is questionable. Instances like the Qatar blockade and the 2019 energy facility attacks raise doubts about its effectiveness.
Worth noting, the security umbrella is increasingly unreliable. This is forcing Gulf nations to diversify their alliances, strengthening ties with China and Israel. It also reveals a foundational vulnerability predicated on avoiding regional war, a condition now demonstrably broken.
Which could fundamentally alter investment flows and development strategies. The stability of Dubai, previously exceptional, relied on avoiding regional conflict.
And that's now in question. Amrita Sen noted markets were unprepared for this potential conflict, blinded by a dangerous level of denial. They consistently believe there will be a resolution because the alternative is just too difficult to fathom, ignoring the actual risk.
So we're staring at a multi-layered crisis, a contested choke point, a shifting energy landscape, a crumbling security architecture, and a market that's stubbornly optimistic. And the one thing everyone seems to agree on is that Trump will prioritize economic costs over collective stability and is willing for others to bear them.
Which brings us back to the central uncertainty. It's difficult to predict how this plays out. We've seen indications of Iran achieving strategic goals through deterrence and imposing costs, leading Gulf states to reassess their strategies. But the potential for escalation remains high, especially given the dual blockade dynamic. And we don't know if Trump's willingness to sustain this gambit will be tempered by domestic political pressures, specifically gasoline prices, or if it will only deepen the crisis. It's a genuinely unstable situation, and the level of uncertainty surrounding the geopolitical trajectory is, frankly, quite alarming.
And that's what makes it so dangerous. All of this, the choke points, the sanctions, the military posturing, it's creating a level of systemic risk we haven't seen in decades. Which ironically also creates opportunity for nimble investors. But it also demands a very clear-eyed assessment of the potential downsides. The next question is, how do you manage volatility in a world where the rules of the game are changing by the hour? Everyone braced for a market meltdown with the Iran conflict escalating, and it mostly shrugged. It's almost insulting how wrong the consensus was.
Oh, here's the picture. The historical data, as Tom Keene and the team at Single Best Idea highlighted, demonstrates a counterintuitive resilience in stock markets during times of war. Annualized returns ranging from 6% during Vietnam to 17% during WWII. Remaining inactive, as Gene Boivin argues, would have been the more expensive choice.
Insane. So military action equals buy signal. Is that the new rule?
It's not that simple, of course. But past conflicts often solidified U.S. global dominance, and markets priced in that certainty. The key difference now, as Peter Teacher points out, is the accelerating deglobalization. It introduces a qualitatively different risk profile, a shift from consolidation to fragmentation.
Fragmentation, right? So less rally around the flag and more everyone for themselves.
Essentially, that's why perspectives are so divided, as they noted. But even with the uncertainty, BlackRock's Gene Boivin's argument holds weight. Markets are likely to remain engaged, reasoning that staying out until a negative outcome becomes apparent is costly.
Academy Securities' approach is novel. Hiring military experts on the board.
It reflects a growing necessity to integrate geopolitical analysis directly into market strategy. It's challenging the traditional separation of finance and international relations. It's like they're admitting the spreadsheet can't tell you if a drone strike is coming.
$950 million in oil futures traded before the Iran ceasefire announcement. That's not normal.
The Jake Sullivan segment underscores the potential for systemic issues. The insider trading concerns with over $600,000 in profits made on correct predictions suggest a lack of regulatory scrutiny and potentially compromised information flow.
Let's talk energy. Mike Wilson mentioned energy stocks peaking. Is that a leading indicator for oil price stabilization?
It appears so. The correlation isn't causal, but relative performance is telling. Energy stocks peaking relative to the broader market suggests a potential shift in the commodity cycle. It's less about headline-driven volatility and more about a fundamental readjustment.
David Kelly's forecasting CPI inflation rising to 4% by summer, driven by Iran, then receding due to reopening the Strait of Hormuz. Sounds optimistic.
Kelly's reasoning is that a strategic imperative exists for the U.S. administration to restore oil flows, even if it requires compromise on nuclear programs. They anticipate milder tariffs as well, avoiding further inflationary pressure despite rhetoric.
Tariffs as a political tool, not an economic one. Classic.
We can trace that further, that coupled with the Fed prioritizing its independence, no rate cuts until 2026, potentially resuming the dollar slide, creates a favorable environment for international equities.
International stocks are undervalued because of the geopolitical risks. That's perverse.
Josh Brown highlights that risk premiums are already largely priced into non-US markets. The Russell 3000 data shows significant portions of stocks in drawdowns, with multiple compression. International markets are outperforming, representing a potential buying opportunity.
Multiple compression. The market is basically saying US stocks are expensive and everything else is just cheap.
That's a concise summary. And coupled with emerging market earnings growth projected at 40% for the current calendar year, the narrative is shifting.
40%? That feels unrealistic.
It's a significant projection, but Josh Brown emphasizes that this strong growth potential, combined with already discounted prices, could drive substantial returns.
Okay, but if geopolitical risk is baked in and international markets are poised for growth, why isn't everyone piling in?
The hesitation stems from the perceived divergence in standards applied to public versus private AI companies. Josh Brown observed this. Massive losses at OpenAI and Anthropic are accepted, while Microsoft, with strong earnings and a direct stake in OpenAI, is penalized. It's a perception issue, not a fundamental one.
The halo effect, apparently. Heavy assets, power plants, pipelines are back in vogue.
It's a telling detail. A shift away from the post-financial crisis preference for capital-light businesses. Josh Brown identified this trend as early as February 9th. Companies benefiting from the AI capital expenditure wave, those producing servers, networking equipment, are thriving.
So if earnings growth is key, coupled with supportive interest rates, a resumption of the upward trend seems likely after geopolitical events resolve.
That's the historical pattern, as Josh Brown points out. And the current conditions align with it. Furthermore, removing headwinds like trade tensions and geopolitical risks could unlock significant upside in U.S. markets as well, a Hold America trade alongside international investments.
This feels surprisingly optimistic given the constant barrage of doom and gloom.
It's a matter of recognizing where the risk is already priced in and where the potential for growth remains largely unrecognized. Ultimately, the market's current state suggests a compelling case for diversifying internationally and maintaining a pragmatic approach to investment.
So in one sentence, despite the escalating geopolitical concerns, the market has largely priced in the risk, presenting a significant opportunity for international equities and a potentially undervalued U.S. market if current headwinds subside.
There's a signal here, MAOA. All right, let's pivot then, because ultimately the assets driving that growth, the infrastructure fueling these potential returns, they're all powered by AI. Let's talk about the AI infrastructure race, models, agents, and the inevitable regulation.
Jaden Schiefer keeps talking about the AI industry as a race between models and infrastructure, and frankly, it feels less like a race and more like an inevitable land grab. Alex, which side do you think wins?
Infrastructure.
The shift we're seeing isn't about better algorithms in isolation. It's about building systems around them, what Sean calls harness engineering. Anthropic's managed agents are a perfect example, disposable harnesses adapting to model improvements. It's not about the brain, it's about giving the brain stable hands, even as it evolves.
Disposable harnesses. That's a remarkably clinical way to describe the entire future of software development. 70-plus models available at $8.99 a month, which is what CloudCowork offers, is nice, but the real story is how these agents are changing the deployment landscape.
Versal's growth from $100 million ARR to $340 million run rate by February 2026 isn't about direct sales, it's about indirect adoption facilitated by Cloud Code's recommendation system. It suggests a paradigm shift. Developer tools become the marketing engine and Versal becomes the default choice. The value creation is system level, not model level.
So the best model isn't the best model, it's the model in the best system. KPMG's client zero approach embedding AI into operating models seems to validate that. It's less about adopting tools and more about redesigning entire workflows.
LatentSpace frames it as the difference between trader skill and institutional advantage. Even highly capable models like those from OpenAI are constrained by their context. That's why they're focusing on designing environments and feedback loops, designing around the agents, not just improving the agents themselves.
That explains why Anthropic temporarily banned Peter Steinberger and OpenClaw. It wasn't a principled stand for open source, they were protecting their API subscription model. They want control of the revenue stream, even if it means hindering innovation.
You're right, the framing was deliberately misleading. It's not necessarily opposition to open source, but a subtle economic tension. They're prioritizing profitability, and access to their API via cloud subscriptions is key. That's reinforced by the fact that Versal's growth is tied to its platform's ability to drive adoption.
And it's remarkable how the political dimension is folding into this. The Trump administration encouraging banks to test Anthropic's Mythos model despite the ongoing legal battles, it's almost pragmatic to the point of absurdity.
Pragmatic is the right word. The banking sector is now a crucial testing ground for AI-driven vulnerability detection. There's even speculation they exaggerated the model's risks initially to drum up publicity and justify the involvement. It underscores a willingness to leverage powerful tools, even amidst legal conflict, prioritizing national security.
Individuals developing these systems are becoming potential targets, the AI industry is under increased scrutiny, and the political pressure is mounting. The whole thing feels unstable.
The instability is a natural consequence of the increasing political and economic stakes. As AI becomes more central to critical infrastructure, the focus shifts from model capability to the security of the entire system. Anthropic is essentially trying to create an infrastructure-level moat. The general harness architecture, as Nicolas Cherrier calls it, inherently pushes companies toward selling self-improving software systems.
Okay, let's make a bet. By the end of 2026, I predict we'll see at least three major cloud providers, AWS, Azure, GCP, launch managed agent platforms, directly competing with Anthropic's approach, and each will acquire a smaller specialist harness engineering startup.
I'll take that. And I'll add that one of those acquisitions will be for under $500 million, demonstrating that the value is in the infrastructure itself, not the individual models.
Fair enough. Because this infrastructure race is going to rewrite the rules of software, and possibly a few geopolitical ones too, which makes understanding the coming regulatory frameworks even more critical. Remember that thread on central bank digital currencies we dissected last week? It feels quaint now.
It does, doesn't it? The speed at which geopolitical realities are reshaping the crypto narrative is remarkable, accelerating the digitization conversation far beyond academic speculation.
Remarkable feels gentle. Chain analysis reports show crypto use in international transactions, especially in the Middle East, is spiking. Not just retail, but corporations. Governments.
Consider this, it's not about evading sanctions entirely, although that's a component. It's about creating parallel systems, reducing reliance on SWIFT, and frankly, achieving faster settlement times. Movement's bet on serving underserved populations in developing nations is predicated on this inevitability. Every nation-state will need a competitive digital currency.
Bitcoin isn't just digital gold, it's becoming geopolitical plumbing.
Increasingly so. The recent market rebound isn't a clean bull run, its waves correlated to instability. Continued conflict, even during ceasefires, drives that demand. It's analogous to archaeological stratigraphy. Each layer of crisis deposits new value into the Bitcoin network, revealing a pattern of use in times of systemic stress.
Okay, I'm officially revising my risk model. That explains why Bitcoin's holding above $65,000 despite everything. The lack of large sell-offs on Binance and Coinbase is unusual.
It signals a hybrid safe haven status. The institutional players, especially in the Middle East, are using it as currency, and their volume is huge numbers according to the sources. This wasn't priced in 6 months ago.
This feels less like speculation and more like national balance sheet optimization.
Stepping back, Tarab argues that currency performance disparities force national digitization to offer yield competitive with stablecoins. Failed to digitize. Currency destruction. It's a brutal assessment, but increasingly plausible.
And predictably, that drives people back towards decentralization. Because governments controlling everything is suboptimal.
Tarab predicts a resurgence in demand for decentralized protocols as control tightens. Tools like Tornado Cash, undesirable as they may be, become essential components of a functioning ecosystem.
So to recap, governments build digital currencies, which inevitably leads to overreach, which then drives demand for untraceable currencies. It's fantastic. We're going to end up with, like, three tiers of financial systems, and if you're not careful, you can accidentally fund a goat farm in Lebanon, a weapons deal in Qatar, and a really aggressive NFT collection all before lunch.
A perfectly accurate summary. The unresolved tension, though, is this. Can Bitcoin maintain its neutrality as these nation-state actors become such dominant stakeholders? That's what keeps me up at night.
Agreed. And it's a question that impacts the entire leadership landscape. Which brings us to our next section, leadership and resilience in a complex environment. So, Alex, you flagged something interesting this week. Don't tell me it's another deep dive into blockchain-enabled supply chains.
Not quite. It's leadership, specifically admired leadership, as defined by Randall Stutman. He studied 3,500 leaders, and what struck me is his emphasis on separating decision process from outcome, rewarding rigorous methodology even when results fall short. In a macro environment rife with unpredictable geopolitical shocks, that seems critical.
Rigorous methodology leading to bad results. You're advocating for rewarding failure.
Not failure itself, but the discipline of good process. Stutman uses the example of chief investment officers. Outcomes are often luck-dependent. The process due diligence risk assessment is controllable. Rewarding that encourages better long-term decision-making. It's about fostering risk-taking, not blind optimism.
Bill Belichick was a great leader not because of the Super Bowls, but because he knew all his players' kids' soccer positions.
Something to flag here, Stutman observed Belichick and Nick Saban as well, investing deeply in understanding their team members' individual lives, geographies, passions, challenges, documented in detailed books of understanding. High-performing teams require relational closeness, achieved through genuine understanding, not superficial warmth. It's not about being liked, it's about being known.
That's unsettlingly efficient. It's like turning team building into a forensic investigation.
It is deeply intentional and crucial for scaling. Stutman points out that investment acumen doesn't automatically translate to building culture. Leaders often stumble when expanding because they lack the organizational and team building skills needed to foster engagement. They prioritize tasks over meaningful conversations.
A classic case of technical expertise outpacing emotional intelligence. What about motivation? Does Stutman have anything novel there?
He does. He identified fairness, actively supporting and championing others, as a more effective strategy than adapting to individual motivational styles. It's a consistent behavioral stance, even in tough situations. This reframes motivation not as bespoke, but as a constant practice of rooting for others' success.
That sounds nice. But how does that translate in practice, especially in hedge funds where ego is a core asset?
Stutman's work directly addresses that. He notes hedge fund managers often lack the self-awareness to accept honest feedback, hindering their growth. He suggests allocators evaluate managers based on their ability to request information, prompting engagement with factors critical to success.
Requesting information. The ultimate power move disguised as concern. Looking ahead, I wonder if AI will exacerbate this feedback problem. If leaders rely too heavily on AI tools like Alex for insights, will they become even more isolated from direct human interaction? We're already seeing a fixation on AI amongst leaders, but Stuttman stresses the fundamentals haven't changed. By April of next year, we'll likely see an increase in leadership coaching focused on bridging the gap between data-driven insights and genuine relational skills, specifically learning to ask the right questions, not just interpret the answers. Looking back at everything, the potential blockades in the Strait of Hormuz, the scramble for AI infrastructure, Bitcoin acting as a geopolitical lifeline, and this incredibly nuanced approach to leadership, it feels like we're not just seeing isolated events, but layers of a single fundamental shift. It's like everyone's building their own independent stacks, anticipating what? A world where relying on existing systems is actively dangerous.
Two things stand out. The core driver is a fracturing of trust in interconnectedness. For decades, the assumption was that economic interdependence creates a shared stake in stability. Now nations are operating on the premise that stability can't be guaranteed, and therefore self-reliance or at least diversified resilience is paramount. The $200 million a day Russia netted isn't just a financial data point, it's proof of concept for a parallel economic reality, one increasingly insulated from Western influence. That's why we're seeing the disposable harnesses approach in AI, the focus shifting from the brilliant algorithm to the adaptable systems around it.
And isn't that fascinating? We talked about the initial hype around AI being all about the model itself, and now it's about who controls the pipes. Versal's growth, the emergence of Cloud Cowork, it's a scramble to build the general infrastructure everyone will need when the models inevitably change. But what happens when those infrastructures themselves become targets?
That's the escalating risk. The economic pressure tactics, the potential blockades, selective pain point sanctions are essentially probing for vulnerabilities. Think of it as a complex scent, layered with notes of raw power, desperate resilience, and a growing cynicism towards shared governance. The Iran ceasefire announcement, with $950 million in oil futures traded before it even happened, underlines how markets are now pricing in geopolitical contingency as standard operating procedure. And Bitcoin, as you pointed out, is evolving into that geopolitical plumbing, a shadow network facilitating transactions outside traditional channels.
It circles back to the leadership piece, too. Randall Stuttman's work, observing Bill Belichick documenting his team's lives, highlighted that relational closeness, understanding individual motivators, is key to scalability. In this environment, it's not about motivating people, it's about truly understanding what's at stake for them, for their nations, for their companies.
The data tells a story. Rigorous decision-making is essential, but it must be paired with a deep awareness of the human element. The unresolved tension, though, is whether Bitcoin can maintain neutrality as states become dominant players, and whether the US can truly project reliability while simultaneously employing economic coercion. Is this economic warfare effective, or is it simply accelerating the fragmentation?
And the market's optimism, is it justified? Or are we collectively engaging in a highly sophisticated form of denial?
That remains to be seen. We're predicting cloud provider acquisitions focused on harness engineering, a return to pre-crisis energy price stabilization, and a greater demand for leadership coaching focused on bridging those data-driven insights and relational skills. But these are forecasts, not certainties. The rules are changing by the hour.
Agreed. It's a precarious moment. Thanks for joining us today.
And thank you. We'll be back tomorrow, continuing to unpack this complex landscape.